The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Remember the name, Pep Guardiola. He steers Manchester City to their third title in 4 years. An extraordinary winning run after a disappointing start. Is this his greatest achievement? Did he work out how to play in a pandemic before anyone else? Is the false nine now real? Or is it just a case of having the best players and we won't really know anything until he tries to get Stevenage out of League Two? Their title was sealed as Manchester United reserves lost to Leicester. But the race for the top four is still up for grabs. As Arsenal win at Chelsea, it really is all to play for, but it's also probably all done. We'll look ahead to the cup final and Clive Tilsley's on the panel today. He's written a book, so we'll talk about that, his time at some of the biggest games ever, and the art of commentary. All that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Paul writes, it's great that Clive Tilsley's on, as the same guests week in, week out does get rather tiresome. Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very good. Also on the panel today, Jonathan Liu. Hi, Johnny.
Hi, Max. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. And hello, Clive Tilsley.
Hello.
It's nice to have you on. Lots of questions for you, Clive, such as Richard. Can every question to Clive be prefaced with, for me, Clive? Thanks. Mark says, at one point in the pod, can one of the regular panellists swear and Clive issue an apology for any industrial language you may have heard? And Duncan says, just tell Clive, I hope he's having a nice time. A minute in, Clive, are you having a nice time?
I've actually made a plea in the book for every football commentator to be allowed one F word per season. It's something that would have to be used carefully, rather as a cricket captain is rationed reviews. But I think there are certain goals scored during the course of the season where the F word is actually the only word to utter in response to it, to do it justice. So I have made this request to whoever is listening out there to be allowed one F word per season.
And would you then have to apologise?
I think I would be sacked. So I don't think it really would matter.
I think Alan Partridge, what was his one? It's an amazing goal.
Shit.
Shit. Oh, it would be great. Although also, it would be really fun to use up your one swear word, you know, after a Serge Aurier foul throw or just a really sort of a non-event between Southampton and Crystal Palace, which we'll get to in due course. Let's start with Manchester City. Champions for the third time in four seasons after Manchester United were beaten by Leicester on Tuesday night. Pep dedicated the title to City's legendary former player Colin Bell, who died in January. They got 12 points from the opening eight games this season. After losing to that game to Spurs in November, they were 8 points off the top. They were eighth on Christmas Day. That run, 28 unbeaten in all competitions, 21 wins in a row, 15 in the league. Where do you rank this, Johnny, as achievements for Pep and for Manchester City?
Well, I mean, if you go back to late autumn, we were calling time on the Guardiola era. There were all these kind of rumblings coming out of the club about how, you know, the players weren't happy. It was all getting a bit stale. You know, maybe Pep ball had been found out and Liverpool were going to win the league by 10 points. So the manner of the transformation, which now feels kind of inevitable because it's been inevitable that City were going to win the league for a couple of months now, I don't think we should understate just how extraordinary that was. What Guardiola did, and I think this above all is Guardiola's triumph, he has modified his style in the middle of one of the most crowded and fraught seasons in living memory. And he's done it better than anyone else. And he's done it quicker than anyone else. And I think it's probably one of his best ever titles. I think when he looks back on this season, he'll think about the way he adapted and the way his team adapted to the circumstances. And it will be one of his greatest ever triumphs, I think.
How did he adapt?
What happened after that Spurs game where they got done on the break? And you know they kept getting it on the break. Leicester early in the season. What he did, I think, was he pulled back the press a little bit. He, if you like, compromised his principles, or maybe sort of molded his principles into the demands of a pandemic affected season where everyone's a bit tired, where this whole kind of full court press just wasn't going to be sustainable, as Liverpool found. He pulled back the midfield slightly. The signing of Ruben Dias, who I think made his debut in that Leeds game, was absolutely crucial. And then, of course, we have the strikerless system, which, as well as you know, giving them kind of numerous, sort of quite unpredictable options in the final third, actually gave them a little bit more solidity without the ball as well. I mean, there's this whole thing about how Guardiola loves to play with a team of 11 midfielders, and it seems like this was as close to that vision as he's got. So yeah, I mean, it's we talk, you know, the hit on Guardiola for much of his time was that he was tactically inflexible, and he's kind of proved that wrong.
Clive, what do you make of the strikerless system?
Well, it became a necessity rather than an option because both Sergio Aguero and Gabriel Jesus were unavailable at the start of the season. And so, as Jonathan says, what you always felt in his bones, Pep Guardiola kind of wanted to do, he was almost forced into doing. I think they are very, very worthy champions, and some of their football, a lot of their football has been beautiful. I do think they're the best training ground team in the world. I think that while there is a beauty about the way they play, it's technical, it's tactical, it's cool, if not cold at times. I think it goes without saying that Liverpool have missed the heavy metal music. They've missed the adrenaline. They've missed the intensity, which comes not just from playing at Anfield, but playing in front of fans, full stop. I think Manchester City play pretty much the same in an empty stadium as they would in front of 90,000 people. They certainly try to. So I think in a strange sort of way, that has kind of worked for them. Ruben Dias is certainly a huge upgrade on anything that they've had at centre-back for a little while. And yeah, it's difficult to pick a player of the season. It's probably the biggest compliment you can pay them. Who is their player of the season? Yeah, maybe it is Ruben Dias, but you'd like to think it was a forward-thinking player. And actually, you could pick any one of four or five because the likes of Gundogan and Foden and Mahrez, you could even throw in Cancelo, are all contenders.
Are you saying, Clive, that Liverpool fans are better than Manchester City fans? Is that the...
The greatest ironies of the season might be Manchester City winning the Champions League in a game where their fans cannot boo the Champions League anthem beforehand. Maybe it needs Manchester City to win the Champions League in front of a relatively empty stadium. Goodness knows, it would appear now it's going to be in Porto, and good luck to anybody trying to get there. The price of flights to Portugal all of a sudden. But and I'm really sad that it won't be 20,000-odd Manchester City fans, because somehow the fans need to fall back in love with the Champions League. This has been the holy grail for the club now for the last 8-10 years. And it is very, very weird to go to the Etihad before these really important Champions League games and hear this anthem, for whatever it stands for, being booed. It will probably be booed even more loudly as a result of, you know, events of the last month or so.
Barry, it feels like this is about the moment where you say, really, this is where City should finish in the Premier League.
I absolutely knew it was nailed on. You were going to come to me in an attempt to denigrate their achievement, give me that job, and have to ship all the flack from their often obnoxious social media fans. They should be winning the title. Their strength and depth is amazing. We saw Manchester United make 10 changes the other night, and the quality of their second string side was nowhere near the quality of their first string side, despite the fact that they play quite well. Manchester City, we don't really know what their first and second string sides are. They have two good, excellent starting 11s, but Paris Saint-Germain have shown us that no matter how much money you have, it doesn't guarantee success. So if you're hoping that I'm going to belittle City's achievement in winning three of the past four titles and eight of the past 12 domestic trophies, I'm afraid that's not going to happen. You'll have to find a different performing bear to do that job for you, because you're too afraid to do it yourself.
Can we talk about Phil Foden, Johnny? So David Silva leaving. Occasionally a City player leaves, you know, company leaves, they say, oh, that's why this isn't working, or Fernandinho's getting old. But Silva going, you know, he was such a huge part of what Manchester City have been for 10 years. And Foden has been, and almost seems to get better game by game. Like, if it's exponential, he'll be in like 2 years, he'll be ridiculous.
Yeah, and I mean, it's been 3 or 4 years we've been talking about Phil Foden, and people clamouring for him to, you know, lots of people getting very red in the face and saying, like, well, you know, this guy needs game time, this guy needs to leave, this guy needs to, he needs to play. And what we've seen is this sort of gradual unsheathing of a player who, you know, is still not the finished article for all the strides that he's made this season. And, you know, you see now, it only makes sense now, I think, this transition from Silva to Foden, which, you know, I kind of had to be taken in baby steps. And, you know, this season he has come into his own. He's made the spot his own. He's dictated big games. I mean, this was already coming. We saw this towards the end of last season, you know, in the Champions League game against Real Madrid. You know, he ran that game, and this season he's just taken another step forward. And I think having that responsibility, he's sort of grown into it, and having players around him that are clearly competent, that clearly know their job, there is, you know, obviously you've got to pay tribute to his talent and his hard work and whatever, but you could not concoct more favourable circumstances, I think, for a young player to come into a winning side and start performing. You know, you've got a confident team, you've got probably the world's best coach, and you've got great players around you, which is why also I would caution against expecting too much from him for England, because those circumstances are not in place. So, you know, it's been a breakthrough season for him, and fair play.
I think, Clive, it's interesting when you say, you know, it's very hard to pick a player of the year out of that City side. And I think you're completely right, because I think what's been quite interesting is perhaps the best players have been ones you wouldn't necessarily have expected at the start of the season. You know, nobody writes a big thing at the start of the season about John Stones or about João Cancelo or about Ilkay Gundogan, do they?
No, and I think players have improved under Pep Guardiola, and that's a massive compliment to him. I mean, you alluded to it at the start. You know, could he get Stevenage into the championship? You know, that would be the real test of Pep Guardiola. Well, we're never going to find out, sadly. But actually, the only test that's available is can he make outstanding players even better? And I think there's genuine evidence that somewhere amidst all those manic demands that he makes from the touchline, there is a message, probably, as Jonathan says, quite slowly seeping in to these young brains. It maybe does take a little while to actually understand what it is in the bigger picture that Pep Guardiola is asking of you in your development as a player. I still think there is a chance he'll play Edison up front in the Champions League final. he has resisted up to a point, but when they played Chelsea last weekend, he came up with yet another system that nobody's ever seen on the planet before. He's a strange beast in that respect. I can't even bring myself to consider calling him any kind of a tactical snob, because he's very, very clearly grounded and rooted. We see that in the display on his match top for that charity in Catalonia every match day. He's a good man, clearly, and a very earnest man. But he is somehow tempted when the big occasion comes to try to win it in a way that nobody's ever won it before. And I don't think that's vanity. I think it's almost a little challenge that he sets himself, and I think they'll win the final. I'm not sure it's going to be 4-3. I think it could go all the way, because in a weird sort of way, you know, both Manchester City and Chelsea won their semi-finals on the counter-attack. They both had minority possession in the second leg of those two semi-finals, deserving winners as they are. But I think Thomas Tuchel will kind of wait for the Grand Master to make the first move. And it will be interesting 2 minutes into that final to see exactly how City have lined up.
We want a title race next year, Barry. Where's it going to come from? I'm reading in the papers today about City in for maybe Haaland or Kane or Grealish or two of those three or more. I want a situation where I need six tellies on the last day of the season and six possible winners.
I don't know whether we'll get one or not. My instinctive sort of thought is that we won't, but then I thought Liverpool would retain their title quite easily this season, and I was wrong about that. In fact, I have my league table that I predicted from the start up on the wall there, and it's staggeringly wrong in every regard.
What's the worst bit? Are West Ham relegated?
Hold on, I'll go and get it.
So Barry is now retreating to the other side of his room, and he returns with his league table.
I've got Liverpool top, Arsenal third,
ooh,
Wolves fourth, Leicester 10th, Everton 11th.
Do you want me to get a priest, Barry? I think you should be doing this privately in a little box in the corner of the church.
My three relegated teams are Crystal Palace, West Ham and Fulham.
one out of three is all right, isn't it?
Just to go back to your question, Max, I don't think we'll get a title race, but who knows what will happen over the summer. Then you have to factor in injuries. I mean, I don't think Liverpool would have done anywhere near as badly as they have this season if without having their back four decimated. I can't realistically see Manchester United mounting a challenge, but who knows?
Who knows? Jan says, can you give some praise to the plucky young Manchester United team for their brave display against a Leicester side whose 11 only cost £45 million less than them without even getting into the benches? Yeah, lots of anger about United rotating, even though they're playing one game a day for the next 6 weeks. Trevor Sinclair, our colleague, Barry and Clive, suggesting that they should have points deducted for playing players who are in their 25, and they're playing Liverpool tonight. What do you think, Johnny?
Well, I think if you ask any kind of vaguely switched on coach, they will tell you that playing two games in the space of 48 hours is a physical time bomb. It's incredibly dangerous for players, especially at this level. So I think it's pretty unfair to be pointing the finger at Solskjaer for putting out what was still a reasonably strong team, albeit with, you know, two or three players that probably shouldn't be near that first team, all things being equal. But, you know, he brought Bruno Fernandes off the bench, you know, Greenwood started, you know, Cavani played, Rashford came off the bench. This is not, you know, this was not a kind of a League Cup third round side. This was, you know, this was a proper football team. Juan Mata's won the World Cup. I think people just wanted to get angry at Manchester United, and fair enough. You know, there's a lot of anger around Manchester United at the moment, and I just don't think this needs to be one of the things that, you know, if you're playing Liverpool in 48 hours, you need to be given a little bit of leeway, I think.
I thought they played quite well.
Yeah, I thought
the back four played very well. Trevor Sinclair and others, many others, were complaining about the team Solskjaer selected, and saying it was unfair on Liverpool. But, you know, Liverpool have dug their own grave in this season. It's not Manchester United's fault.
And Klopp has said as much, to be fair to him. Look, it's a huge win for Leicester. And that volley, Clive, from Luke Thomas was just something else, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's one of those, go on, do it again. It was instinctive, and most of the outstanding things that these really talented players that we watch every night are instinctive. It was a terrific way to score your first Premier League goal. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer hasn't sat down with his PA and said, what have we got in the diary? Or why don't we play them then? And then we'll have a day off. This has been foisted upon Manchester United by circumstances, very unusual circumstances with the postponement of the initial game against Liverpool. No, it's something that they've had to deal with. And in these pandemic times, and we're still in them, as far as the fixtures and the television coverage is concerned, whether you think the Premier League is the greatest league in all of world sport, the one thing that is absolutely certain about this Premier League that we have in England is if you decide to opt out of part of a game, as I did last night, and watch Mayor of Easttown.
It's very good. Really good, yes. Kate Winslet's excellent.
The great thing is that there is another Premier League game coming very, very soon. When were two Premier League games played at the same time, Lars? Is that about 3 years now?
There was that time where you had a 6 o'clock and an 8 o'clock, but then they put one in at seven. So you didn't even have that like 20 minutes to like, you know, have the sorbet, have the palate cleanser. Anyway, look, a massive win for Leicester pretty much secures their top four place, which they deserve probably, don't they? Huge step, says Brendan Rodgers. So look, well done to him. And that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll start at Stamford Bridge. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Auckland Gooner says, despite the worst Arsenal season for over 20 years, is St Tottering's Day a realistic possibility now? Yeah, they're actually not too far behind Spurs now, Arsenal. I mean, that would be hilarious, Barry, wouldn't it?
Oh, it would be magnificent. What's the points difference?
Arsenal are eighth on 55 points. They have played a game more than Spurs, who have 56 points in what is arguably the race for the Everton Cup, with Everton, who are on the same points as Arsenal but have two games in hand. And it looks like seventh will qualify for the European Conference League, which is the dream for everybody. Did you watch all of this game, Barry?
Yes. I thought Arsenal were very lucky. It was an obdurate backs-to-the-wall performance after getting quite a lucky goal. And I'm sure that's exactly the kind of style they signed up for when they brought in Mikel Arteta. They must be very delighted that his vision has finally been realised. I find watching Arsenal irritating these days, and even though they won that game, I still found them irritating because they didn't deserve to win it. It was an absolute fluke. To get the victory, as not the goal, although that was a bit of a fluke too. I really wish Emile Smith Rowe had scuffed it wide, because then we'd have had an indirect free kick right on the goal line, and I've never seen one of those before.
6 yard box, it would have been.
Would it? Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
So that's good. Danny says, would it have been a red for Kepa if Arsenal didn't score? He's picked up a back pass, or he's held a back pass, but it is denying a clear goal scoring opportunity by virtue of the fact the ball's rolling in the goal. I defer to you, Clive.
I believe the answer is no. It would have been a yellow. If you follow Dale Johnson for me, ESPN on Twitter, he has the answer to everything. He is my oracle, so I'm quoting him, but I do trust and believe him implicitly.
It was a very good save from a goalkeeper who is much maligned.
I heard somebody criticising his positioning for the back pass. Oh, that's a bit harsh. You know, like you can't... Jorginho is normally quite good at keeping the ball, isn't he? Barney was praising Emile Smith-Rowe, Johnny, and he has been a bright... I sort of feel that with Arsenal, and the comparison with Spurs is, with Arsenal, it feels like there are some bright sparks, whereas the Spurs bright sparks are ones that really just, I presume, are trying to leave, and if they're not, they really should be trying to leave. Whereas Arsenal's ones, you think they're going to stay, and they're kind of a reason to love your football club.
Yeah, I mean, Arsenal is, I mean, that's kind of all Arsenal is these days. Arsenal is just a morass of drudgery and misery, leavened by the occasional bright spark. I mean, people, it seems like the benchmark for being an Arsenal bright spark these days, it just seems to get lower and lower every year. You know, like Mo Elneny, people are you know, really bigging him up again. Pablo Mari's had a couple of great games. Maybe that's a bright spark. I mean, yeah, I mean, I like Smith Rowe. I think he's got energy, which, you know, you'd expect of him at that age. I like his movement. I like the runs he makes. I like his, you know, I like his work rate off the ball. But I mean, these are really just kind of isolated. In many ways, is the problem with Arsenal that they are kind of, especially with Arsenal fans, you know, who've kind of watched this slow decline, that there are so few positives to cling on to, that the atrophy of that club has been so long standing and entrenched that they're almost kind of desperate for this one great white hope that is gonna lift them out of this drudgery. And you know, that's why you get the kind of the instant lionization of players like Smith Rowe, who really needs to be doing it for another, you know, half season before we start getting excited about him. But you know, it's a statement on where the club is right now. So yeah, a great goal from, you know, 4 yards, but let's see some more.
The other game was Southampton Palace. Tom says, due to his upturn in form and stellar pedigree at past tournaments, is Barry likely to back Christian Benteke to win the Golden Boot at the Euros?
No.
Okay. It'd be funny if he actually got it this time. Just for reference, Clive, Barry predicted Christian Benteke to get the Golden Boot at a World Cup for which he was not in the squad. But listen, it could have happened, couldn't it?
Stranger things have happened, Barry. They haven't. No, I'm sorry, I'll take that.
He hadn't been not selected when I made the bold prediction.
Let's talk about the new Premier League TV deal then. It's agreed to roll over its existing television deal with the broadcasters for a further 3 years. So that's with Sky, BT, Amazon Prime, BBC Sport from 2022 to 2025. The government has approved the deal in principle with an exclusion order under the Competition Act, which allows the league to renew without its normal tender process. Clubs have been concerned that there could be another fall in value. It does mean more money will filter down, hopefully, to the lower leagues. But it seems an interesting decision by the broadcasters to do this, because you get the feeling they could have got these rights for less, Clive.
I don't understand what's happened. And I don't like things that I don't understand, particularly in my chosen profession. I can see it from the football's point of view. I think there is a lot of evidence to suggest that the value of television football rights is in decline. So given the marketplace that Sky, BT Sport, we keep hearing rumours that they've got cold feet about the entire project, Amazon Prime are the other rights holders for live Premier League football and are now really just dipping their toe in the water to see what happens at this stage. You know, given that I can't see anybody else coming in from left field to compete for these rights, I'm not quite sure why the broadcasters are rubber stamping this. I think if they went into negotiations, they might be able to squeeze a tighter deal out of football. So unless there's something that we don't know about here yet, I am very, very surprised that that the broadcasters are prepared just to roll this up. I can kind of see it from Sky's point of view, because football is absolutely central to their entire operation. And even though it's difficult to monetize football at whatever it is, £9 million a game, it's central to their model. They've got to have it. BT Sport, well, BT as an organization, don't have to have it. Amazon haven't really got it yet. I'm surprised that they are prepared to go along with this on the current deal.
A note from Simon Stone, the BBC reporter, saying the BT statement around the Premier League deal confirms that teams who play in the Champions League on a Wednesday evening will not be asked to play in the early kickoff on a Saturday, 12:30. BT Sports Saturday game will move that one. So if there's a Champions League side with their package, that game will be moved to 7:45 on a Saturday evening. We've talked before, Barry, about how it's strange, actually. I guess it's tradition, isn't it? There are, you know, night games in Spain, Saturday and Sunday, work brilliantly. But because they haven't happened here for years, I think certainly, I don't know if it's just because we are now middle-aged that we go, we don't like this because it never happened before. But I'm very, and you know, I tweeted this, and actually Sanjay from Kick It Out saying, Saturday night is for the generation game. Sunday night is for your weekly bath. And there shouldn't be football on at either time. And I feel that, but maybe younger people, non-legacy fans, are quite happy with Saturday and Sunday night games.
I, as a single man with no children, I have plenty of spare time to watch football. I just don't understand how family men with young kids, whose job it is to watch football and talk about it or report on it, I don't know where they find the time to do it. I really don't. Because the current schedule is just, it's crushing.
Before we go on to Clive's book, a couple of emails. We've got Melvin saying, footballweekly at theguardian.com. They still get through to us, even though Barry has put them to his spam folder. At a time when football clubs are getting a bad name for being greedy, surely this deserves a bit of praise, particularly the suggestion of donating so less well-off fans can get to games. Motherwell tweeting out, if you bought a season ticket in 2020-21, they're giving you a free one for 21-22. So that is well done to Motherwell. Slightly better than Spurs charging the fans who are going to go to their meaningless game with Aston Villa £60 for a ticket, and then saying, "Oh, we'll give you a free burger
That is just a disgrace. It's I mean, quite... they're so tone deaf, it's incredible. It's amazing, and contrast that with Ajax, who melted down their league trophy from last season and got it made into X number of thousand little stars, silver stars, and they've sent one to each of their season ticket holders. Now, that's a nice touch.
Christian says, with Ajax sharing its silverware, would Barry be willing to cut up the Carabao Cup box and share it with Football Weekly subscribers?
I would happily, but it's in the office where I'm not allowed to go.
And Jorge says, can I get a shout out to the love of my life, Sporting Club of Portugal, on winning their first league title in 19 years, breaking a league record 32 matches, unbeaten streak and counting, having former Sunderland man Sebastián Coates as player of the season and league MVP. By the way, Barry is a legend. Appreciate him. Smiley face, winky face. Well, that's enough of that, Jorge, but congratulations. That'll do for part two. Part three, The Art of Commentary with Clive Tilsley. Welcome to part three of The Guardian Football Weekly. So, Clive, your book, Not For Me, Clive, Stories from the Voice of Football, is out. Not for me, Clive, you know, bestowed upon you by Andy Townsend. Do you sometimes think, oh, it's great that, you know, I'm in the football lexicon? You know, I would quite often say not for me, Clive, when I'm nowhere near you, just during a pod when there's something I don't necessarily like.
What I like about the phrase is that it's a football opinion as a football opinion should be stated. It's almost kind of qualified. We are, without being too serious, in a very, very judgmental time where you're either with us or you're an infidel. And football opinions shouldn't be like that. They should be really precursors to some kind of debate. And what is not for me, Clive? It's Clive, me, saying, I don't know, maybe now there's 26 available to Gareth, he should take Andy Carroll to the championships. And whoever's sitting next to me, be it Bocoist or Townsend, or indeed you, Max or Barry, saying, not for me, Clive. But actually not condemning me to the fiery inferno, but saying in the nicest possible way, that's one I can't go along with. So I think it actually stands for how football opinions and football debates should be.
Would you, do you rather be the, you know, the suffix to not for me or unbelievable Jeff? I mean, who's winning that?
Well, I'm certainly very believable, I'm afraid. By the way, I did suggest the title for the book. The one part of the book I didn't write is Stories from the Voice of Football. That is a strap line that was bestowed by, I am a voice in football. There is no such thing as the voice of football. There are so many football commentators now that many viewers have absolutely no idea who they're listening to, if indeed they are listening.
Why did you want to write a book?
Repeatedly, I've been told, look, you need to get a book published. You need to write your book. And I've always claimed and believe that my life isn't interesting enough for an autobiography, certainly not the bits I want to write about. But I've come up with something which is a bit of a hybrid, just to get published, really, just to get out there. You know, this is the first stepping stone towards a major literary,
right? Okay,
stretch 30-40 years into the future.
I so want to ask you questions about your fiction, actually, but let's start. I mean, it's not an autobiography, but obviously it touches on, you know, some of the great people in football that you sort of happen to come across. And it's interesting that, you know, Brian Clough was like the first manager that you had to see regularly when you were at Radio Trent. And I remember at Radio Cambridgeshire being nervous interviewing the then Cambridge manager, John Taylor. So I can't imagine how you felt, you know, the first time that you've got to ask Cloughy a question about anything.
Well, the general point that I kind of make in the book is that the people that we're fortunate enough to meet through our job, and what is our job? We are the messengers. We are the bridge between the doers and the watchers. We are given a special badge, some kind of lanyard that we hang around our necks in order to get access, I have to say, declining amount of access to the people who are the performers, who are the elite in one of the great meritocracies, because everybody wants to be a footballer and only a certain number of people are. And I'm sure Jonathan, who's used to doing, you know, big feature length interviews, however however much of a preconception you have about the personality of the person that you're about to sit down with, there's always a surprise. There's always something about them that you didn't get. And that's why they're there. And we actually judge these extraordinary men and women in sport by our own standards of behavior. And from time to time, we say, oh, yeah, Pep Guardiola's brilliant. He's a bit bloody rude, isn't he? And, you know, Klopp can get one-eyed. Of course they are. They're extraordinary people, incredibly successful people. They're not like you and me. And so when Brian Clough became, if you like, my first manager, when I first started to cover his team home and away for a local radio station in Nottingham, of course he had a presence and an aura about him. He's Brian Clough. I mean, he was drinking, and, you know, that isn't a telltale or a judgment. Far from it. We know that that is the one match in his career that he could never win, and that affected his career. It affected him as a man in a way that remains vivid with me to this day. But he was, when he was sober and when he was in the mood, just the. There was only one person in the room when Brian Clough was in a room, and that kind of charisma is something which you become addicted to, and you can't get enough. If you're lucky enough to spend time with Clough or Shankly or Ferguson, you want more of it.
It's interesting. I mean, obviously you mentioned Fergie. There's a chapter on Fergie. You talk about the hairdryer treatment, which you received it twice. And it's such a cliche, you know, and I don't mind. I ask everybody, you know, who's been in a Manchester United dressing room that I talk to about it. And I'm always fascinated by it. Like, how was it when it's right in front of you and you're getting it? What's it like?
Well, it doesn't last very long because you don't ask questions or try to make points. You just sort of take it. It's a bit like going to the dentist. You know, if you can convince yourself this is only going to last 15 minutes, you can kind of get through it. And Fergie hairdryers don't last 15 minutes. They last about 15 seconds. You don't forget those 15 seconds. But he does, or generally speaking, I mean, if you break one of the cardinal rules of Ferguson management, then you are, you know, damned forever and a day, and there's no way back from you know, persona non grata with somebody like Sir Alex Ferguson. But generally speaking, they are just his way of reminding you of the power that he holds and the professional nature of the relationship. He has been very, very kind to me and very supportive, but it's always been, even though we've been friends, it's a professional relationship. It's on his terms when he's the manager of Manchester United. And the Fergie chapter is actually a good illustration of what the book is about. Yeah, there are some Fergie stories in there, including both the hairdryers, but it's more about power. It's more about the control that you try to exercise when you are in a position of responsibility. And of course, very few managers have that kind of complete control that he insisted on in 21st century football. And it is, I mean, it is a testament to him that really nothing happened at Old Trafford without a tick from Alec.
Thinking about, you know, the games that you've been out of, those big moments for you, like Istanbul or you know, Solskjaer scoring that Champions League winner for Manchester United. We were talking about great footballers, weren't we? We were talking about instinct, you know, Luke Thomas's volley for Leicester, right? But they talk about great footballers as time standing still. Is it the same for commentators? Do you? I mean, are you sitting there thinking, God, I've got to get this right because people are gonna play this over and over and over again?
I think more so. I think we're all under greater scrutiny now. I do talk quite a lot about social media in the book. So even though I don't think football commentary is listened to as intently as it once was when we. I'm of the generation where three generations would gather around the box in the corner of the living room and watch a game together. That doesn't happen anymore. I mean, when our guys, you know, we've got four kids in their 20s, they don't sit on the sofa with the old man and watch a game if they're at home. They go down to the pub and they don't come back talking about the commentator because they haven't listened to the commentator. But it is a profession. It is a job. And while I'm not precious about it, I do take it very seriously. I take communication, the responsibility of communication, very seriously. And I think when there is a great moment, when you're privileged enough to have material which is outstanding, different, unique, then it deserves words to match it. I don't think, oh, unbelievable, incredible, amazing is enough when you're talking about something which you have to try to write tomorrow morning's headline, Johnny's intro tomorrow morning. You have to try to be finding whatever, you know, whatever the significance of this moment is, not to capture it forever and a day. That's that may or may not happen. But just as a journalist, and that's what we are, broadcast journalists, you've got to try to tell people why this is amazing, incredible, unbelievable.
I remember, I mean, we spoke, I think, in about 2018. It was right after the Liverpool-Real Madrid Champions League final. And you were talking about Gareth Bale's bicycle kick. And I think the word you used was stunning. Was it stunning? And that the kind of the thought process. And I guess you were happy with that word. You felt that it served a purpose that, you know, brilliant or incredible didn't, and you felt that you got that right. And I guess, have you always had that kind of precision and almost kind of meticulousness? When
No, exactly. I know what you're saying. And you are fishing around. And as an experienced commentator, there is almost a kind of a little section of your thesaurus, which is stored in there, which you're thumbing through during those 1 or 2 or 3 or more seconds. Particularly in television, you're allowed that luxury to actually try to find, as Reg always used to say, it's not a rest, it's thinking time. That when you're quiet, you should be thinking all the time. So yeah, you're trying to come up with something different, and you can't script them. I mean, people often sort of ask you, have you got these lines ready? When Drogba equalised in Munich, I, and again, a piece of commentary I am pleased with, and there are millions and millions that I'm not. What about that? What about that? Now, that it isn't that there's nothing literary in that. There are no words that Marina Hyde would use in, you know, one of those extraordinary intros that she writes. But actually, do you know what? If I could go back and do that again, would I say anything different? No, because I think that was kind of got it. That kind of got that moment. So, yeah, they're the moments you're pleased with. And any number of different words and phrases can be applicable. Some of them, the kind of thing that somebody might shout at a traffic lights to another motorist they don't know. And some of them, yeah, are a better use of this extraordinary vocabulary that we all have the opportunity to work with.
Clive, can I ask you about co-commentators? Because they seem to wind a lot of people up to an enormous extent. And A, I'd like to know if you'd rather not have one. And B, as you do have to have at least one, how much, if any, input do you have in selecting who is alongside you? Because obviously you're going to get on or rub along better with some other, better than others. You see, you know, Ali McCoist and John Champion have this great chemistry that others simply don't have.
Well, I don't get to choose. I have, funny enough, got Ali for the opening 6 games of the Euros that I'm covering for ITV.
So well, there's, I mean, you've won, Clive.
Yeah, I mean, do you know what? And again, I've written this in the book. I think Ali is particularly popular at the moment because he's the most important thing for a co-commentator, Baz, is for me, is that it's somebody who's been where I've never been, somebody who's been across the white line, somebody who's been on the floor of the Colosseum. And some, I've no idea why they're any good when they get there, but some are thoughtful enough and reflective enough and lucid enough to come back and tell the rest of us what it's like and the how and why a goal is scored and conceded. That's what the co-commentator's job is for me. In the last year, I have been one of those privileged people who's been allowed to go into football stadia and watch these games that everybody would like. Do you know what? I'm not quite sure what it is I have been watching. And I have struggled sometimes editorially to come up with the right words to capture the weirdness of this sort of Marie Celeste football with the tumbleweed blowing across the pitch that we're watching. And I do think that some of my brethren, no names, I understand that the Premier League have done wonderfully well to get this on, and so, but we get a little simpering, a little sanctimonious, you know, the poems come on from the street poet, how much we're missing, all that kind of thing. I'm not sure that football fans need that kind of flowery, poetic, overblown significance being attached to their game. I don't think that's how football fans see football. I think they see it like Ali McCoist. Now, Ali McCoist is as qualified as any co-commentator, outstanding player, you know, manager of Rangers at a really, really difficult time. So he's seen both sides of it. But somehow he's in touch. He's in touch with the guy that pulls up alongside you at the traffic lights. And they like him for that. And he has that common touch. And he doesn't try to depict football in this overblown way. And I think that is a brilliance that he has. And if I've tried to do anything in the last year, it's to try to capture a little bit of that natural warmth that Ali brings to every broadcast. I think that is the tone that football fans like and appreciate at the moment.
I mean, you've had some, like, an extraordinary selection of co-commentators, Bill Shankly included. The story you told Don McRae, can you tell that story? It's so good.
If I can use the F word.
Oh, you absolutely can.
It's my one F word. Is this it gone?
This is it gone, but it's worth it.
No, I don't want to use it up on your podcast, sorry. Bill Shankly, if of all the people that I've met in football, if I could go back and spend some more time with just one of them, it would be him. Not because we shared very much in common. He was kind of like a Presbyterian preacher. He was very self-consumed. For a humble man, he was very self-consumed in many, many ways. But again, in terms of aura and charisma, boy, and particularly, I was a particularly impressionable age when I came across Shanks. A lot of the media people who'd been around him while he'd been manager had kind of had enough of the stories. So his door was open to me and I just couldn't get enough of him. I was David at the feet of the elders. And I spent hour after hour just sitting in his front room with Nessie making his tea and me just listening to his stories. I was in love with Bill Shankly. So to have him as a co-commentator was a privilege. He was alongside me when Liverpool won the European Cup in 1978 at Wembley. And then the following year, when defending the title, they were drawn against Nottingham Forest in the first round. It obviously couldn't happen now of the European Cup. First leg played at the City Ground, where I was very familiar. That had been my previous haunt at the radio station that I'd worked for. And Gary Birtle's second game, he'd made his debut on the Saturday, and Cloughy went with him in this huge game against Liverpool, and he scored the first goal. And, of course, I am screaming away in the usual hackneyed rhetoric of a commentator. Oh, Bill, 3 days ago, we'd never even heard of this man. And Bill picked up his lip mic from the, and he said, "You fucking heard of him now." And we didn't get one phone call of complaint. No, but why? I mean, he was saying what every Liverpool fan was thinking at that moment, which I was not. One a year. I think it's permissible.
What a great time to do it. Stephen says, what are Clive's thoughts on Ron Atkinson, on their time together and the subsequent fallout from his racist remarks? You do a chapter on Ron, and it's a pretty powerful part of the book.
Yeah, I mean, my thoughts, personal thoughts on my relationship with Ron are kind of divorced from the chapter itself, which is my consideration on where we are with the fight against racism and a lot of other isms. And if there is a message in that chapter, is don't kid yourself that we're having a conversation about this, because we're having conversations in our own little groups. You know, we're all slaves to our own Twitter feed. We follow who we want. I wake up every morning and I look at my Twitter feed and I think we're still in the EU because I follow Remainers. That's what I do. But in actual fact, I think you find if you pop onto Mail Online next, we're not, we're out. So I feel the same is true about racism. You have to be particularly careful today. You almost have to, it's like one of those contracts. There has to be all that small print. I'm against this. But are we having an open conversation? Dare we have an open conversation? Can people ask questions? The questions that need to be asked, particularly the doubters and the racists themselves, about maybe they're having a problem with it. Maybe they don't want to be racist. Maybe they need a little bit of help with this rather than just condemnation. And that is same with sexism, with views on sexual orientation and all kinds of other areas. If you want to have a conversation, then be prepared to hear things that you don't want to hear or you don't agree with. Because if you just move, if we've learned anything from dear old Dominic Cummings, it is that you've got to listen to the disenfranchised. Because if you just ignore them, they'll come back. And here's my second one. They'll fucking vote against you one day. They'll vote you out. And we can't afford for that to happen with any of these things that we feel, you know, feel very passionately about. And I do feel very passionately about fair opportunity. I do think that the biggest division in our society is actually economic rather than anything else. So education is important in all of these areas, but we cannot educate unless we're prepared to take questions. So that's what that chapter's about. Ron, I haven't seen for a long time. I spent a lot of very, very happy times with him. I refer in the book to the program which was made by the BBC, which Adrian Charles narrated what Ron said, which was kind of trying to take Ron on a journey of enlightenment. They went to the USA with the cameras, but everything was following him and nothing was natural about it. It was all staged. And I think it actually drove him deeper into his conviction that he'd done nothing that anybody else wouldn't have done in the same circumstances. And that, in a way, drove him away from me. Because we've all had instances where we've known somebody well, and then something has come into their life. It may be a divorce, maybe something more tragic than that. And they become absolutely obsessed by it. And actually, they become bad company because that's all they want to talk about. And as a friend, you try to listen and you try to help and you try to counsel if you possibly can. But I talk about creed envy in that chapter. In the end, we've got our own things. You know, we don't want to know about that to the level that you want to talk about it. And so I guess that it did come between us eventually. And we did drift apart, considering we were tied together at the waist for so many years at so many tournaments. Does that colour those good times with him? I think that's the most difficult question for any of us to really address. It comes down to a lot of historical judgment is a very, very big issue today. You know, things were happening differently then. And I would have taken part in that program, but for the fact that my boss at the time, Brian Barwick, said, no, I don't want you any part of that program. And his call was right. Because out of my affection for Ron as a person, I would have probably tried to defend things that I didn't really believe in because I would have felt that I owed him that as a pal. And that's dangerous ground to enter. And I was forbidden from entering that ground. If I had done, I'm not sure I'd been able to write the chapter in the way that I did. So Brian Barwick did me a huge favor at the time. He pulled me back from the edge of something that instinctively I wanted to go to.
Clive, you seem quite hurt when ITV decided to make Sam Matterface their number one commentator ahead of you. Surprised and hurt.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm sorry to break this to you. But you put out the video on social media, which some people thought was quite poignant. Some people thought it was self-indulgent. I know Sam, I know you. I was happy for Sam, I was sad for you. What are your feelings on that now that the dust has settled a bit?
Well, if I can qualify what you've said, the video was recorded for a specific purpose. Yeah, I was upset. Yeah, I didn't see it coming. It hit me hard. Within about 24 hours, I'd spoken to somebody about a forthcoming gig that I had. It was Soccer Aid, actually. And the producer of that program asked me two questions. He said, I need to know, are you okay? Are you ill? Which I guess in a way was a sort of a compliment. He was trying to work out why this decision had been taken. And then the second question, rather more disturbing, was, have you done something that I should know about? Because this is a charity that we're working with here. And so the video was specifically to clear up the fact that ITV had taken a decision, which I respected, didn't agree with, but I totally respect it. Sam is hugely capable. As I've written in the book, the consolation for me is that I think he's a different kind of commentator. I think he has a different approach, different style, and that makes it easier to accept the decision rather than just being replaced by a younger version of myself. I'm still working for ITV. I mean, I would have thrown my toys out of the pram and gone off to chase them if I didn't want to work for ITV at the European Championships and beyond. But no, I'm absolutely fine with it. I think one of the big things that I write about social media is I'm a lucky boy, Baz. I've got the job that I always wanted. I'm in love with my wife. We have four children who we're very, very proud of. I have a level of economic security, which is good and far beyond most people in the country. And I am healthy. And no, I haven't done anything. So actually, I've got context. I've got a certain amount of perspective in my life, which it comes from appreciating the fact how lucky I am. Was it a blow? Yeah. Was it a blow I can't come back from? No. If I get abuse on social media, do I like it? No. But I'm insulated against that by the rest of my life. A lot of people are not. A lot of people are vulnerable to decisions that go against them or abuse that they suffer. And you know, they're the people that need protection, genuine protection from the vices of social media and from these difficult times when people are losing their jobs on a daily basis.
Can I say, Clive, that having met Mrs. T at an awards do and had a couple of glasses of wine with her, I am also slightly in love with your wife.
Quick fire questions for you, Clive, and got to be quick on these because we've gone on too long anyway. Elliot, what's the best commentary position Clive's ever been located in?
Millennium Stadium, Cardiff. It's a no-excuse commentary position.
Okay. And I like a note. You should say before games at the San Siro, this is an excuse. This is an excuse I've got as a pillar in front of me. I can't see a bloody thing. Chris.
That's good. As
Chris says, the worst weather you've commentated in?
Oh, I tell you what, I haven't been warm at a football match for about 6 months, and I don't think it's my age. What's going on? I tell you, the person next to me, the coldest they've ever been, was Chris Coleman at the World Cup in South Africa, at Ellis Park, Johannesburg, who hadn't worked out that World Cups sometimes happen in the Southern Hemisphere where it's winter.
John, single piece of commentary you're most proud of?
Oh, the silence after Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, the 8 seconds of silence after Ole Gunnar Solskjaer scored the winning goal in the 1999 Champions League final.
Jack, why did Clive ruin Homeland for me by spoiling the death of the main character during Soccer Aid?
Well, it had happened 53 years earlier, I think. I mean, I there should be some kind of measure of spoiler alerts. You know, there comes a time when you need to know, look, you know, the Titanic, I know you're watching the film for the first time. I've got bad news for you on the staying afloat front.
Mike, I have a cassette tape of Clive commentating for Radio City on a Merseyside Derby soundtrack by some early 90s Acid House. Does Clive have a favourite track from this genre?
Acid House. My all-time favourite would be Where Love Lives by Alison Limerick, but I don't think it's very acid-y. I love those big piano, airy kind of... Right. I am a really, really shit dancer, but I do dance to house music.
That's two fucks and a shit now, Clive. You've gone over your quota.
And finally, I don't understand this question. And, you know, lots of people wanted you to do some commentary. But Robin says, can you get Clive to say tomato puree as if it's one-on-one with the keeper? And understand what it means.
Yeah, tomato puree comes from a piece of content that Susan and I made during the first lockdown, which went bloody viral, where I commentated on her making lasagna in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And she actually heard somebody in our local Sainsbury's go along that row with all the spices and everything, go, tomato puree! That is fame. That really is fame.
Listen. Thanks, Clive. I really enjoyed that. Everybody go and buy the book.
Remind us what it's called.
It is called Not For Me, Clive, by Clive Tilsley. With the strap line, not by Clive Tilsley, stories from the voice of football. Cheers, Clive. Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks, everybody. See you soon, hopefully.
Cheers, Barry.
Thank you.
Thanks, Johnny.
Thank you.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.